I want to thank Rav Trivitz for a very original, enlightening explanation of the Netziv. Also, Rabbi Trivitz, I think one of the makoros of the Netziv here is the Amunah Bahashgacha, which was written by one of the Talmidei HaGra, who discusses this concept as well. I have. Our second speaker tonight, Rav Yitzchak Breitowitz Shlita, is known in the United States, now here at Tzeinu HaKadosha, for his scope of knowledge, brilliance, as well as his unique ability to grasp very complicated material and to communicate it clearly and effectively. Rav Breitowitz is a Musmach of Neri Yisrael of Baltimore and a graduate of the Harvard Law School. He has lectured extensively through the United States and Israel on medical, business, and family ethics, and has published numerous articles on bankruptcy, commercial law, medical ethics, family law, and halacha. He has authored Between Civil and Religious Law, The Plight of the Aguna in American Society. Rabbi Breitowitz served as professor of law at the University of Maryland and served the Woodside Synagogue in Silver Spring, Maryland as its Rav until he made Aliyah a year ago. Currently, he's a Magid Shir at Or Sameach, and he continues to lecture internationally and is an extremely popular speaker for the Le'ela program on Sunday mornings. Welcome, Rabbi Breitowitz. Thank you in advance for addressing us.
We'll see.
Give me the signal.
When I'm giving the signal.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. And again, I want to thank both the OU and the Le'ela program and Mrs. Rivka Siegel for the tremendous amount of work that she does to bring some extra dimensions of Torah even to Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh. And, of course, I want to give a yashkoch to Rabbi Trivitz for his very erudite and creative presentation. I will be a bit simpler, simply because I'm not as complicated a thinker. But on the other hand, essentially I will be building on his insight to bring it down in a more lemaisa dika way. We have a pasuk in the book of Bamidbor, where after Korach, after the ground opened up and Korach died, there's a statement, Lo siya ke Korach v'adasai, there shall never again be something like Korach and his congregation. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin actually says that is the negative commandment to make machlokas. But there's actually a beautiful thought from Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz once remarked that Korach v'Adasai against Moshe is the only example in history where one side was totally wrong and the other side was totally right. And in effect, the Torah is telling me there will never again be a machlokes where one side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong. Rather, the nature of human interaction and Jewish interaction is there will be emes in both sides. And therefore, if you ever kind of take the position there is no truth in the other side, that itself is violating Korach v'Adasai. Another thought from the beginning of the book of Bamidbar. We know that the Jewish people were counted 1 month after the Mishkan was put up. The Mishkan was put up Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The beginning of Bamidbar requires the Jewish people to be counted 1 month later, B'yachad l'chodesh hasheni. Rashi points out that in fact this was not the first census of the Jewish people. The Jewish people were counted immediately after the Chet HaEgel. And the half shekel that was contributed was melted down and used for the Adonim, used for the sockets. Why is there a need to count the population within the span of 6 months? What is the purpose of the second minyan? In Parshas Pinchas, where we're counting them at the end of the 40 years, which is a whole new generation, we understand why they have to be counted. They're not the same people. But in the beginning of Bamidbar, between the Chet HaEgel, which is after Yom Kippur, and the Hakamas HaMishkan, and 1 month afterwards, same population base. What's the purpose of the second minyan? Rashi says, Derech Chiba, Rashi says it's way of God showing his love for Am Yisrael, that he counts them again and again and again, like a miser counting money, Derech Chiba. But one of the Mahalchim that Meforshim give us is that there's a very important lesson here. There's a tremendous distinction between the first census and the second census. The first census is a very anonymous census, meaning everybody dropped a half shekel in the pushka, and Moshe Rabbeinu computed the shkolim and multiplied by two, and he got the total population. Moshe did not meet any individuals. We don't know how many Reuvens, how many Shimons, how many Yehudas. It is simply a glop. It is simply a bunch of money in a pushka. By contrast, in the second census, number one, we're given a tribal division. How many in each shevet? And number two, the Ramban says very beautifully on the words mispar shemos. The Ramban translates mispar shemos, not the counting of names, but the narration of names. Meaning, even though there was a machtas shekel that was given, but each person had to personally introduce himself to Moshe Rabbeinu, kind of onerous, and give his name. That Moshe Rabbeinu should understand, oh, this is an Avram, this is a, I don't know if they use the name Moshe yet, but this is whatever names they would use, and the like. And one might suggest that these two sensei, or censuses, whatever the correct plural is, represent two different visions of community. There is a concept of community that might be based on what you call a melting pot model. And that's like a cholent in the middle of the week in which all of the different ingredients are simply glopped together and they merge into an undifferentiated mass in which individuality is not treasured. Rather, individuality is supposed to be squelched. Individuality is supposed to be sacrificed for the greater good of the community. And that is a melting pot model. In America, for example, that was the traditional model until multiculturalism. That was the traditional model. No concept of second language instruction. You're in America, you learn English. You know, that type of thing. And that is one model of community. And the Torah is suggesting, in the aftermath of calamity, like the Chet HaEgel, when the very survival of the Jewish people was at stake, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a machshava to abrogate his covenants because we broke our covenant, it was time to get rid of your individuality, not to be autonomous, to simply go with the plan, merge in an undifferentiated cholent, and indeed that was necessary. But the lesson of the second minyan is that that is not the long-term concept of community that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. That, as Rashi uses the Lashon, Kishebo lahashrei shechina aleihem. When God is putting his shechina on Am Yisrael, you need a different type of community. Not a community that is based on melting pots, but a community that is based on salad bowl. And the difference between a salad bowl and a cholent is that in a salad bowl, we have our lettuce and our tomatoes and our celery and our peppers. And each of them has a distinct color, a hue, a taste, but it's precisely the combination of diverse elements within, of course, the framework of Torah and mitzvahs, as Rabbi Yaakov points out. All of the different shvatim are arranged around the central core of the Mishkan. And therefore, the concept of the second minyan is melting pots are necessary in times of emergency. But the true beauty of Am Yisrael and the true Hashras Hashchina comes from a recognition of these diverse viewpoints, different hashkafas, different ways of looking at things, in which each of us learn from the other. And as a result, that is the idea of the second minyan. The second minyan is a different version of community. Some have said that we are still in a state of emergency because of the Holocaust. Some have said we have not yet recovered. One needs to think about this. This is not for me to be machria. But one might at least venture the thoughts, again, I'm certainly not my chiddush, venture the thoughts, that perhaps we veered too much in the direction of homogeneity, of sameness, of squelching the idea of looking at other points. And again, I'm talking about points within Torah, but the primary tenor of my remarks, paradoxically, And again, Rav Tribbetz built on this as well. Paradoxically, you know, one might say that, you know, how do you deal with reform, chiloni? But the truth of the matter is, perhaps that's not the biggest challenge, because I know because of Kiruv Rechokim and the like, very often we have positive attitudes. We could be much better towards reaching out to those who are not religious and those who are not affiliated, because we feel that they're fertile ground to implant them with our ideas. But what we find very, very disturbingly is that the labels of apikoris, the labels of kofer, the labels of chutz l'machana are not being directed so much towards those who truly reject Judaism, but to those who are shomrei Torah u'mitzvos, but have ideologies that are a little different, off the beaten track. They become the kofrim, they become the apikorsim, and I say they, I mean, whatever. We call them, they call us, it makes no difference who the they and who the us is, it just depends who's talking. And yet, perhaps implicitly, this is the very message of the idea of Shvatim, having a different mission, a different personality, a different framework of avoda. And you can use so many metaphors, whether you use the metaphor of a symphony, whose beauty is the combination of different notes, or a tapestry, or a mosaic, you can use all sorts of visual or auditory metaphors. The beauty of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah is the fact that there are many drachim. And sometimes we sacrifice that, perhaps because of psychological need for simplicity, perhaps because, and I can understand that, I'm not even dismissing that either, perhaps because complexity confuses. I know in my own yeshiva teaching career, I sometimes get flack for mentioning certain ideas, and I say, well, these ideas are not false. They confuse people, and we're not supposed to confuse people. And again, that's a position that is worthy of concern. But we have to understand that even if we adopt that type of strategy, at most, that is the lesser of two evils, perhaps. That is not an optimal good. The beauty of Torah lies in its richness. And that is the two visions of the community. There's a thought from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky on a very intriguing medrash. The medrash tells us, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to create Adam, the different angels in heaven were arguing that Adam shouldn't be created. Some were in favor and some were against. The angels of Emes, of truth, said, Lo Yivra, don't create man, he's full of lies. The angels of Chesed, of loving kindness, said, give him a chance. Man is capable of kindness. The angel of Shalom said, don't create, full of machlokas, full of arguments. The angel of righteousness said, yes, but man can do good things. So it's a standoff. It's two against two. God doesn't know what to do, kavyacha. So the Medrash tells us, God took the angel of Emes and threw him out of the ring to the ground, as the Pasuk says, Emes me'eretz titzmach, truth comes from the ground. And at that point, it's no longer two against two, it's two against one, right, in favor of man. Chesed and Tzedek are in favor of man, so God creates man. So what's going on here? I mean, there's a tie, so God just throws out one of the votes? I mean, what type? I mean, if God wanted to be a tiebreaker, he could have just broken the tie, right? But apparently, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not function as tiebreaker. There's a two against two. He gets rid of one of the angels. What's going on? So Rav Yaakov gives a very, very beautiful pshat. And I think it's very relevant to how we view these different shitos in Klal Yisrael. And he says, what is the meaning of emes in Torah? And this is a point that Drashas Haran makes, and even the Ramban in the Hakdama to the Mochames Hashem. Is emes of Torah the equivalent of what we might call mathematical truth? In mathematical truth, at least in standard Euclidean mathematics, not getting into the more exotic varieties, there is generally only, let's take arithmetic to be simple, only one answer. One and one is two. If you say it's three, you're wrong. It's not your opinion. It's not a range of legitimate shitos. You're wrong. In the halachic system, and certainly in the hashgafic system, by and large, that's not how it works. The Gemara itself says, when there's a machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and one says kosher, one says treif, one says butcher, one says chayev, which one is right, even though operationally we follow one view? The Gemara says, Beferish, Elu v'elu divrei Elokim chayim, these and those are the words of God. And what can that mean? Obviously, it's very contradictory. What did God tell Moshe? If halacha is a question of ascertaining what the Ribono Shel Olam said to Moshe Rabbeinu, did Hashem tell Moshe yes or no? How can yes and no both be right? It's the old famous joke about the person going to the rabbi and presenting his position, and the rabbi says, you're right, and the litigant presents the other position, you're right, and the Rebbetzin asks, how can they both be right? You're both right, you know, you're right too. How can it be? So the Drasha Saran is Masbir, that the Torah gave the Chachamim a methodology, a structure, and a process. And it left it to the Chachamim to utilize that process to come to various conclusions. And as long as one is faithful to that process, and as long as one is qualified, and that's a big issue, who's qualified, obviously, then whatever conclusion is come up with is given the imprimatur of Emes, because it followed the methodology and the process and the fundamental yesodos of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. People make a big mistake when they look at Torah Shebal Peh as a big mass, giant mass of information, and all the Chachamim do is carry around a sack in which they pass it from person to person. I once heard a well-meaning, a very, very, very well-meaning and righteous young man who said he had emunah shleima that when the Chafetz Chaim wrote the Mishneh Berurah in the 1890s, he was simply transmitting a word-for-word transcript that had been handed down from all of the generations from Moshe Rabbeinu. That's obviously not so. Abaya and Rava, Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, they're not arguing over what Hashem said to Moshe. They are taking the principles that Hashem said to Moshe and using it to extract applications of which people differ in logic and in reasoning. Right? Torah Shebal Peh, within the framework of those principles, is dynamic, is creative, is interactive. It is based on the fact that we recognize truth by looking at different viewpoints. What is a daf of Gemara other than by different facets of reality we come to emes? So, based on this Drasha Saran, Rav Yaakov says, going back to the Medrash, if emes is understood not as a fixed arithmetical point, but as the culmination of process, then there's much less reason for machlokas. Because if someone sees it differently, it's not that they're wrong and I'm right, but rather within our viewpoints are contained various facets of multiplicity of truth. So what the Medrash means is the following. The two negatives against man are emes, man is filled with lies, and shalom, man is filled with the potential for katata, for machlokas. Rav Yaakov says those two are connected, because if there's only one single indivisible truth, then when someone doesn't have that truth, I will fight with them, I will hate them, I will disparage them, I will demean them. But what did God do? God redefined the concept of emes by throwing it to the earth, meaning emes now becomes process rather than point. So it's not a question God got rid of one of the votes, but by redefining the meaning of emes, shalom now becomes enabled as well. Because I look at someone with a different shita. It doesn't have to be he's wrong, he's bad, he's illegitimate. If I can see the emes within that perspective, then there's going to be shalom as well. So it's not even a question of Hashem eliminating one vote. Hashem changed the two votes by redefining emes may eretz titzmach. There's not even a taina of shalom. And indeed, the Ramban, as I mentioned a moment ago, the Ramban in the Hakdama to the Mochames Hashem, one of the most erudite Talmudic works ever written, specifically says, the Chachma of the Torah is not like the Chachma of mathematics. The Chachma of the Torah is based on conclusions drawn from fundamental principles for which there can be disagreement, for which you can very rarely say something is wrong or right within this miskeres. And thus, one has to understand that in Klal Yisrael, there have always been not just machloksim on technicalities, but there have been machloksim on fundamental issues of Judaism. just to make it within the past 150 years. We have the Hashkaf of Rav Shimshon Nefal Hirsch, Torah im Derech Eretz, which talked about, again, what that means exactly is itself a machlokas, but the notion of integrating Torah with secular chachma. Some say good, some say bad, some say treif, some say valid. As I say, there's a machlokas. If Rav Hirsch's shita was a temporary emergency measure for the massive defections of Judaism that was occurring in Germany, or whether it was an optimal hashkafa and the like, it's fairly clear that although it was interpreted as a Horat Shah in Eastern Europe, Rav Hirsch himself probably did not interpret it that way. The Musar movements, which as great a person as the Chazon Ish was against, because he felt that the Musar movement was too involved in introspection and was not necessarily rooted in halachic particularism. Chassidus versus non-Chassidim, secular studies, Zionism, the role of Medinat Yisrael, the role of women within a halachic framework, and I triple underline halachic framework because I'm not focusing so much on those that are beyond the pale of halacha. Even the concept of zealousness, in other words, how rejecting are you of ideas that are not your ideas, is also a machlokas within Am Yisrael. Meaning to say, part of our appreciation of the panorama and mosaic of the Torah is to understand the position of those who do reject all sorts of ideas. One has to know that even in Eretz Yisrael itself, there is actually an older Yerushalmi tradition, it's kind of almost dead today, of a certain tolerance of living. Now again, there are always kanoim who are sometimes very, very strong, but there was an older tradition of living with diversity. Understanding that in the world there are many types of Jews. Understanding that even if one has a certain hashkaf and a certain chinuch, that doesn't passel someone else's hashkaf and someone else's chinuch. This applied, of course, to other religious Jews, but it even applied, to divert from my main topic, it applied to non-religious Jews as well. If you look at Gedolim like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who represents an old Yerushalmi tradition because he was a Yelid Yerushalayim, you look at Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, who is very close to Rav Kook. You look at Rav Eliyashiv, may he live and be well, in the earlier stages of his life, where for many, many years he was a dayan in the Beis Din HaGadol, working with great friendship with Zionist judges, Dati Leumi judges. These were his chaverim. These are his chaverim, as it were. People forget that aspect of the story. And one of the stories, again, apropos of nothing in particular, but it's just a beautiful story that shows you what a real hashkafa is. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach he was the Rashiv of Kol Torah in Bayit Vagan, and he lived in Shari Chesed. And for most of his career, he took the bus. He didn't take a cab. Only later he had a driver or a cab, but he took the bus most of the time. It's a long, long bus ride. And there were a number of times where women would perhaps sit next to him in the bus. Today, not only do we have Haredi buses, but we hear, and again, this is a minority, and this is not to, it's not representative of everybody, but we hear about even violence against women who happen to sit in the wrong seat. Again, minority, minority, minority. What happened when a woman sat next to Rav Orbach? A few things. Number one, he didn't ask the woman to not sit there. Okay, well, maybe that's obvious. That would have been the rudest thing to do. Number two, he didn't even get up and move, because that would have hurt his feelings, hurt her feelings. Number three, he didn't continue to sit there because he was machmer in that halacha. What did he do? He got off the bus. He told the woman he had to get off the next stop, which was Machane Yehuda, because he didn't want to embarrass her, and he just walked. He either took another bus or walked. I don't remember exactly what happened, but basically he got off more than a mile before his destination. Do you see the exquisite balancing of a gadol? Meticulousness in the halachas of yichud, whatever, I'm not giving any psak on that particular issue, but at the same time, such a concern not to embarrass, not to hurt, not to communicate a holier-than-thou attitude. This was a gadol b'Yisrael, and chaval al di'avdin v'lo mishtakhin. that, at least in an open way, we often don't absorb this today. Of course, the Gedolim still have it. The Gedolim have it. But sometimes it doesn't penetrate to us. But again, that's a little beyond my topic. My main point is that within Torah itself, there is such a diversity, such a beauty. And the whole Hishtalshulis of Torah Shebal Peh says that we learn and we understand by seeing the whole diversity of viewpoints. Why in the Gemara do we spend so much time on machloksim that we don't paskin like? Why do we learn Beis Shammai's rules? We don't paskin like Beis Shammai. Why do we look at a Hava Amina? What did the Gemara think? Who cares what the Gemara thought? Let's just look at the conclusion. The answer is, you don't understand the conclusion unless you understand all the different components. You don't understand Torah im Derech Eretz unless you understand the Hashkafa of those who believe in only Limud HaTorah, and vice versa. You don't understand what a Misnaget is unless you understand what Chassid is. You don't understand the Chazon Ish's opposition to Musar unless you understand the good and the potential criticisms of Musar. So yes, that makes life confusing. That makes life complicated. And I can understand, every parent, you know, in our own family, we have to make a judgment, you know. Can my kids take it? That's why, for example, I found The Making of the Gadol, well, again, as one of the absolutely best books ever written, again, in terms of understanding the complexity of the realities of the Torah world, the stresses and the strains, the different shitas, the different approaches, the fact that, you know, we lump Rav Chaim and the Meshech and the Or Sameach and the Chafetz Chaim and the Netziv, we just put them in the pantheon of great, great people, which of course they were, without always recognizing there were nuances between them, there were differences between them, they had different approaches. And in a way, when we go into this, we understand our relationship to Hashem much better, and we can find what is our derech. What is the derech that speaks to us? What is the derech that elevates us? What is the particular, right? I mean, it's like, lahavdil, if you had a radio that only had one station that played one song, after a while, you know, you're not sure if that's the one you want to hear all the time, but there's no other choice. But there are choices. But these are not choices, chas v'shalom, outside of the miskeres of Torah. And unfortunately, what sometimes happens is, God forbid, if Torah is represented in only a particular way, and that way doesn't work, then the alternatives you're leaving for a person is to go off the derech, when instead there needs to be an understanding of what is within the derech. Jerachaha darchei Noam is a plural. There are jerachim, there are mahalchim, there is the salad bowl, there is not just the melting pot. So when we look, for example, when a bachur in yeshiva tells me that, well, we understand that Rav Kook is not really a gadol in our world, you know, it's something to rip kriya over. Rav Kook had unusual shitas. Rav Kook had shitas in which many gadolim did disagree with, and these were deep, deep machloksim. The role of a Jewish state, of course Rav Kook was nifter before the Jewish state, the role of non-religious or anti-religious people in the building of Eretz Yisrael, which Rav Kook viewed positively. The Netziv, interestingly enough, is very interesting that, and again this confirms exactly what Rav Tribbetz said, that although the Netziv seems to have been the humanitarian, the Netziv actually wanted to cut off, he wrote letters to Baron Rothschild urging him to cut off funding to anti-religious kibbutzim in Eretz Yisrael. He felt that they were defiling the Kedushas Haaretz. Right? So Rav Kook had shitos, which were controversial, in which one can understand the pros and the cons. Once again, we're not going to just put it in one big cholent of gedolim, but to say that he was not a gadol, Rav Kook, who was the Masader Kedushin of both Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rav Elyashiv, Rav Kook, who... Actually, Rav Zevin writes that Rav Kook may have been the last gadol who knew Kol HaTorah Kula. That's actually what Rav Zevin writes in one of his svarim. So to say that to raise our children and our yeshivos with the idea that this is not a person who was a gadol, that Rav Orbach called Maran his whole life, it's really very much of a travesty. And it comes from the idea that we are so afraid of exposing our children to all of these different shitas, that we have to delegitimate, we have to demonize, we have to castigate. And our own Yiddishkeit is very impoverished as a result of not having that input, without having that that understanding. So these are things that we really have to be very, very cognizant of. The diversity of Torah, the richness of Torah, itself is a big antidote to sinas chinam, because then I can look at the other and I can see the value in what they're espousing, in what they're teaching. The truth is, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and Rav Chaim had a very interesting career. Rav Chaim, married the Nitziv's granddaughter, and for around over 10 years, Rav Chaim was the junior Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, until the Volozhin Yeshiva closed. And Talmidim had a choice which shir they wanted to attend. The Nitziv had a very different derech than Rav Chaim. The Nitziv was the great, great Bucky who knew Kol HaTorah Kula, but he had a more simple pshat-based derech. Rav Chaim conquered, and still conquers, the whole world of the yeshivas, which the depth of his analysis, and Bachram gravitated. There were those who were Nitziv. Rav Kook was a Nitziv person. That's correct. That's correct. Rav Kook was a Nitziv person. Other people were Rav Chaim. Rav Isser Zalman was a Rav Chaim person, etc. So there were different Talmidim who gravitated to different Rosh Yeshivas. Rav Shimon Shkup was a Rav Chaim person, but then he went to the Nitziv because he saw the Nitziv's great Avas HaTorah and Amelus HaTorah, etc. The idea that to understand this diversity is very, very fundamental. But Rav Chaim once said an interesting point about Kanos. Rav Chaim was very different than the Nitziv in personality-wise. The Nitziv was involved in at least the early stages of Zionism. The Nitziv was a supporter of Chovavei Tzion, which was kind of a religious precursor to Herzl and the like. The Nitziv was very involved. Rav Chaim, on the other hand, which is still the Masorah of Brisk today in Eretz Yisrael. You know what they say? The Briskers in Eretz Yisrael are the anti-Zionists. The Briskers in America are the pro-Zionists. That's an interesting point. But the Brisker Rav's anti-Zionism comes from his father, Rav Chaim. But Rav Chaim once remarked on Kanos that the relationship of a true Kanoi and a false Kanoi is the relationship of a housewife to a cat. If a housewife buys a cat to kill mice, they have a certain common interest that if there's mice, the cat should kill it. But the difference is, the housewife would be much happier if there wouldn't be any mice around. The cat would be sorely disappointed. And he says, there's a certain type of kanos that almost gets a joy in exposing the soft underbelly of the things that people do wrong. Let's read every line in this book to find if there's a shemetz of avikorsis. Let's be medayak in a footnote to see if something is a little off kilter, etc. And there's a certain joy in exposing the chesronos of another. There are times, Rav Chaim says, that we have to speak out. There are times that we can't be silent. There are times in which we have to make the Torah position clear. But we do so with sadness. We do so with regrets. We do so in a spirit that we would much rather be able to work with someone, to respect them, to love them, to embrace them. When we take that step, the Kanoi takes that step with reluctance and with sadness. But when there is such a joy to find the shortcomings of others, Rav Chaim, who was a great Kanoi, Rav Chaim was a great Kanoi, Rav Chaim says, that is the Kanoi of the cats. And that is why Pinchas is described in the Torah as a descendant of Aaron, because Aaron's Midah is Oev Shalom Verodev Shalom. And Rav Chaim says, if you want to be a Pinchas, you have to come with the attitude of Oev Shalom Verodev Shalom. If you're not a descendant of Aaron, you cannot take on the mantle of Kanos. So these are things we need to think about, because once again, Kanos, even L'Shem Shamayim, has many, many costs, many, many psychic costs. First, it makes a person cynical, judgmental, and negative. Because if you get in too much of the habit of always being critical about others, then eventually you become cynical about your own Rosh Hashivas, your own rabbis, your own Torah. In fact, we see this. Chazal tell us that Pinchas eventually became Eliyahu HaNavi. And Eliyahu HaNavi lost his faith in Am Yisrael, because Am Yisrael were worshipping idols, and even after the miracle in Mount Carmel, they went back to worshipping idols. And Eliyahu HaNavi basically says to God, Es briska heferu! They annulled your bris, forget about them! And if you look, basically, HaKadosh Baruch Hu fired him at that point. It says, go appoint your successor. You've lost faith in your people. You cannot be their leader. And some Mefarshim draw a connection that the kanos of Pinchas, which was totally l'shem shemayim and a great mitzvah to combat wrongdoing, had the effect of turning him into a person who could not see the good in Am Yisrael eventually. And that is why the Medrash says Eliyahu HaNavi is condemned, so to speak, to go to every bris, because Eliyahu HaNavi says the Jewish people don't keep the bris. Hashem says, what do you mean? Bris Mila? Now, we would like to go to a bris, but every day, all over the world, it gets a little hard after a while. He has to go to every single bris to show that even Jews who are far from Hashem have something good in them, that they want to do a bris or a Pesach Seder, a Seder as well. So you become what you criticize, so to speak. You lose that ability. In fact, there's a beautiful passage, Lahavdil. Mark Twain has a passage about... It's very, very eloquent. It's about a person who becomes a doctor, can no longer see the beauty in the human body. He talks about, he's giving an example of a dancer. You know, a dancer might be so graceful, but the doctor, all the doctor can see is the stretching of the tendons and the ripping of the muscle fibers. And Mark Twain wrote that before he was a pilot on the Mississippi River, he just saw this beautiful, beautiful river. But now that he's a pilot and he's aware of the stones and the shoals and the pitfalls, he says he can't enjoy the river anymore because all he sees are the dangers and the like. In many, many ways, the idea of ideological purity and the kanoi acquires that jaundiced view of the Torah that could be so beautiful and so rich and so filled with insight. But you're scared. You can't look here. You can't look there. You can't do this. Can't do that. You have to have blinders on, like a horse, to be the straight and narrow. The second point I want to make in terms of the notion of condemning others is a thought, again, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz made. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz said that there is a law of nature, of spiritual nature, that when we hurt others, it comes back to haunt us, even if our hurt is justifiable. Hurting somebody, l'shem shemayim, doesn't mean something's not going to happen in return. Like just for example, if I jump into a fire to save a baby, did I do the right thing? Yeah. Am I going to be burnt? Probably. And he brings a beautiful raya from this. Chazal say that when Haman was geyser that the Jews would die, and Mordechai hears about it, so the pasuk says, Vayizak za'aka gedayla umara. Mordechai cried a bitter, loud cry. And Chazal point out that exact lashon appears only one other place in Tanakh, and that's by Esav. That Esav emitted a Zaka Gedayla Umara because Yaakov took the brachas. The Medrash tells us that because Yaakov took away the blessing from Esav, causing Esav that pain and that anguish, the descendant of Esav, which is Haman from Amalek, gets the power to cause the descendant of Yaakov that identical pain and agony. Now, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, what's going on? Yaakov didn't do an aver without getting into the pshatim. Our assumption is Yaakov did what he had to do. It had to be done. Yaakov is going to be penalized? Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, it's not a question of penalty, it's a question of consequence. Kachi darko shalaylam. The pain and humiliation that we inflict on others is going to come back to bite us one way or the other. Now, that doesn't mean you don't do what you have to do. Sometimes you have to be willing to take the hit. But know there's a hit. And that's important because we sometimes jump to conclusions too quickly. It's l'shem shamayim, it's a mitzvah, I'm doing the right thing. Well, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. But do know that you're going into shark-infested waters. When you get into the realm of hurting others, condemning others, embarrassing others, there's going to be a cost, even if it's a Yaakov doing it to an Esav, al pi Hashem. A third point is, Dr. Fun mentioned the machlokas l'shem shamayim. Pirkei Avos says, a machlokas l'shem shamayim, sofo l'hiskayim. Now normally that's understood in a positive way. People who argue l'shem shamayim, that will continue to endure, it'll be studied, it'll be learnt. But in the Hasidic Shesvarim, they say a bit of a sharp homiletical thought. And they say, when people think they're arguing l'shem shamayim, that type of machlokas never ends. Sofo l'hiskayim means it goes on forever. Meaning to say, it is very, very hard to do tshuva, because if you think, if we think, we're 100% right, then we think it's a mitzvah to keep on fighting. And once again, at least when a person argues over something he knows is not right, at least we have the charata that might lead us to tshuva. These types of machloksim can go on and on forever. And finally, focusing on the shortcomings of others is often a convenient excuse not to look into ourselves. It is so easy to blame Mashiach on something the other person is doing or not doing. Whoever the other person is, the other movement, the other shita, if only people would be like me. You know the old saying, anybody to the right of me is a fanatic, and to the left of me is an apikairis, a label that is thrown around indiscriminately. Where I am is the right place, wherever I happen to be, without recognizing that there are ranges to the right, to the left. You know, many beliefs can be mistaken, and they're not kfirin. I don't want to get into too many controversies, but you know, if somebody says Lubavitcher Rebbe was Mashiach, a person might say that these are mistakes. A person, again, I'm not even going to tell you what position I have, but might say it's a mistake, might say it's wrong, might say there are proofs against it or for it. Okay? But what does that have to do with kefira? What does that have to do with apikorsis? What does that have to do with delegitimation as an observer of Torah and mitzvahs and kiruv rechaikim? Not everything that's incorrect is in the realm of kefira. One can have a machlokas, not me, but Gedolim can have a machlokas with many of the shitas of Rav Kook. That's fine. It's a machlokas, that's a discussion, that's learning. Let's learn Makoros, let's learn Chazal, let's discuss even pragmatically the dangers and pitfalls or the benefits of these various approaches in keeping Klal Yisrael together. And that's a wonderful, fertile discussion. But to say, label something as apikorsis, kfira, what, I mean, the term, you know, the term gets debased, becomes a meaningless term when we talk about ideas within the Maskeres of Torah with that type of vocabulary that has never been, well, I'm not saying it's never been, because there's always been that, I mean, Kanoz itself is a Shita, but certainly that would not be a proper use of those terms. Now, interestingly enough, there's a fascinating comment of Rav Shimshon Afal Hirsch, who suggests that perhaps there might be a difference between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz, but he makes it in the opposite direction that you would think. When Yaakov Avinu gives a blessing to Shimon and Levi, or blessing, well, he gives them kind of a very strong rebuke, and he says, Achalkein bi Yaakov, Afitzein bi Yisrael. Let them be scattered or divided among the tribes of Jacob, and let them be scattered among the tribes of Israel. In other words, they shouldn't be together. Shimon gets dispersed, his different cities, and of course Levi gets dispersed. Rav Hirsch points out, what is the difference between Achalkeim and Afitzeim, and what is the difference between Yaakov and Yisrael? Rav Hirsch says a fascinating point. Rav Hirsch says, now Shimon and Levi represent the Kanoi, the zealots who, when they see something wrong, have to correct the situation, even at great danger to themselves. Kanos! Rav Hirsch says, Achalkeim means may they be duplicated. We need more of them. And Yaakov refers to the Jews in Chutz La'aretz. He says, in the Gola, when we don't have a strong Jewish society, when the Torah is not kept as well as it should be, we need more Shimon and Levis in the world. Achal Kain, let's duplicate them, let's clone them. Let's have people who stand up for the Torah and don't give in to the secular zeitgeist. But be Yisrael, in Eretz Yisrael, we should weaken that effect. Let's diffuse them, meaning to say, Achal Kain is to duplicate them. afitzeim is to weaken them by dispersion. And he suggests that in Eretz Yisrael, this is Rav Hirsch's comment, in Eretz Yisrael, there is less of a room for this kanos than there would be in Chutz La'aretz, because in a Jewish country, there is a greater capacity to create a richness of Torah freer from secular influences. Again, as history has emerged, it has tended to be a little bit of the opposites. One might argue that the historical circumstances of the land of Israel and the Medinat Yisrael have not been what Rav Hirsch assumed they would be. Again, discussion, once again, something to discuss, something to think about. The point is to think about, not to simply shut off and say, treif, apikorsis, kfira, we don't do that. Right? One talks, one thinks. That's what Torah Shabbat Peh is about. By the way, a little cute story. The Chafetz Chaim once went to see Rav Chaim in Brisk to ask a shaila. By the way, Rav Chaim was regarded as the Gadol Hador. People don't always know this. It wasn't just his yeshivish learning. He was regarded literally as the greatest Gadol of in a door of many, many Gadolim. And the Chafetz Chaim wanted to ask Rav Chaim a shaila. Rav Chaim was davening mincha. Right after Rav Chaim davened mincha, a simple balabas came into shul and simply said, Rebbe, how come there's so much machlokas in the Gemara? And Rav Chaim thought for around a minute and said, you're very wrong. Even though there's machlokas, but for every machlokas in the Gemara, there are many, many more common assumptions that are not articulated. And therefore, the areas of agreement are much, much greater than the areas of machlokas. For example, the first Mishnah in Sukkah discusses a machlokas if a sukkah is kasher if it's more than 20 amos. Machlokas. The Mishnah starts with a machlokas. But that machlokas presupposes a mitzvah of sukkah and a mitzvah of 7 days and sechach and everything else. So Rav Chaim says every machlokas presupposes so many areas of agreement that there's much more agreement than machlokas, even though in the Gemara itself there's more machlokas than agreement that's articulated. So the story goes that the Chafetz Chaim was silent on the way back to Radin, but around 2 or 3 hours into the trip, he remarked, that Rav Chaim is really a gon. So the way they explain the story is, Rav Chaim went through Shas in like 1 minute, and concluded how many machloksim have common agreement. The Chafetz Chaim did it for an hour and came to the same conclusion. So he said, wow, Rav Chaim is right. But the point is, this could be a prototype for how we view these different shitas, dati, liumi, kolel, chasidus, musar, torim, derech eretz. Yeah, machloksim on very fundamental important issues. But look at the commonality of agreement. Torah min ha-shamayim, taryag mitzvos. The importance of Limud HaTorah, of Chesed, of Torah Avayda, Gemilas Chasadim. The Machloksim get the most attention. But look at the commonality of those assumptions. How can we afford to simply cut people off that way when there's so much we have in common and we're so small in number? And the hashpa that we can have on the world and on those who are far from Torah is so much greater if we would come together. This is the idea of sinas chinam. This is again what the Nitziv is talking about when he says looking at others and calling them apikorsim and the like. That is the idea of Torah Shabbat Peh. That is the idea of the creative process. All of this are things that we have to think about during this particular time. The Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, based on the pasuk in Iyov that we recite on Kaparis, Erev Yom Kippur, Kaparis. Right? So it says, "Im yesh malach minei elef, lahagid liyodam yashrei." If there is one angel out of 1,000 that can declare a person's righteousness, Hashem says, "Pidaeu mireda shachas, redeem him from going into the pit." Matsasi kofer, I have found his redemption. The Gemara in Shabbos says, the Midah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that in Shemayim, even if there are 999 angels that say a person is unworthy, and there is one angel out of 1,000 that says the person is worthwhile. And then the Gemara goes on and says, even if 999 parts of that angel say the person is no good, and it's only 1,000th of an angel that is 1 out of 1,000. Hashem says, good enough for me. Good enough. And with us, again, I'm talking about myself. I don't mean to give musr to anyone. I mean, I'm, as they say, I'm talking to myself and people listen. But often, often, we can have a chisaron, that a person can have 999 positive features. And like a laser, we focus on the negative. It happens in all sorts of trivial things. Sometimes a child might, I'll give you just an example at random. Your child wants to wash your dishes for you while you're away and makes a mess of the kitchen. And you walk in and you see water all over the floor. The first thing we often tend to notice is how come the kitchen is so wet? Without knowing that the child, without thinking, the child may have spent 3 or 4 hours, whatever it is, trying to do something good. And if we cultivate this idea of seeing the good in people, now this already, again, goes beyond the issue of ideological diversity. This goes, whether it's chilonim, whatever it is, to see the value in others, to see the goodness in others. Then there's a special zechus there, because that's how Hashem focuses on us. The old vortz, Hashem tzilcha, Hashem is like your shadow. Wherever you go, that's where Hashem goes. We focus on the good within people. There's another beautiful word Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says. There's a Avos de Rabbi Nosson that says, you're supposed to emulate Hashem's ways. Just like Hashem judges people akaf sechus, you should judge people akaf sechus. A beautiful statement, but at first glance it makes no sense at all. Judging l'kaf sechus says, give you the benefit of the doubt. I see you going into a McDonald's, let's say in the States, not kosher, or downtown Yerushalayim also, whatever it would be. And so I'm mechuyev to assume that you're using the bathroom or you want a glass of water. I got to give you the benefit of the doubt. So what? So too, when Hashem sees me going into the McDonald's, He'll give me the benefit of the doubt. Hashem doesn't have doubt. I mean, how is it yitachein, the musak, of judging l'kaf shechus, kalapei HaKadosh Baruch? Right? It doesn't make sense. Hashem gives me the benefit of the doubt? So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, beautiful, beautiful, practical insight. He says, judging l'kaf shechus doesn't only mean giving people the benefit of the doubt. It does mean that as well. As you know, Rebbetz and Samet's book, The Other Side of the Story, very often we misinterpret things. But he says there's a deeper meaning. That is, ever since the chait of Adam HaRishon, the Eitz Hadas Taivara, every single human activity is an intermingling of good and bad. Actually, it goes back to Rav Chaim's word about the machlokas, korech v'adasai. Meaning, our good is not totally good, because our motives are not l'shem shemayim always, we don't do a mitzvah completely. So in our good, there is bad. But in our bad, there's a certain type of good in the sense of exoneration, mitigation. Now I got angry, but things were tough. So in the taiv, there is ra, and in the ra, there is taiv. Judging l'kaf sechus is not only giving people the benefit of the doubt. Judging l'kaf sechus is when you look at another person, do you choose to focus on the good within his actions and personality? Or do you choose to focus on the negative? When Avos de Rabbi Nosson says, Hashem judges l'kaf sechus, it is expressing the same idea as the Gemara in Shabbos, that Hashem looks at the good within the person, even if there's much bad. And the lesson is, we can do the same. So it's not a question of naivete. It's a question of recognizing the multiplicity and the ambiguity, well, not ambiguity, but the fact that human action is multifaceted. There are many, many different components. And we choose. Nobody can take in all of reality. In fact, I think technically, that is really, some describe autism as this, right? Reality, there are a billion things hitting me at any given time. And a human being, by definition, has to choose and focus. They say the problem of autism is an inability to choose and focus. So there's a certain paralysis as too many stimuli are hitting you. So by definition, we have to be selective. We have to choose the segments of reality that are going to dictate our responses. And once you're in that realm of choice, there are many different choices you can make. To choose to focus on the good and the positive, to choose to focus on the negative. You can do whatever you want, but the point is, whatever choice we make is the choice the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to make about us. We choose how we're going to be evaluated. We choose how we're going to be judged. It starts from the decisions that we make in terms of what we choose. So, again, I've been talking about a few different themes. Again, my primary theme is simply the multidimensionality of Torah and the richness of Torah and the fact that we shouldn't automatically be afraid. Now, I will say this. Once again, a tolerant person also has to understand the position of intolerance and understand the legitimacy of that position, because that's part of being tolerant and understanding of all of the approaches of Torah, including the approach that says you can't allow anything else. And here, let me just tell you that sometimes people say, you know, no, I'm a recent Olam myself, and you know, we like to come in and think we're going to change Israeli society, you know, for the better, because we bring the American values of tolerance and openness and getting along with people, and we will show this society how to get along. Right? That's, I mean, I think all Americans have a bit of hubris in that sense. You know, we will change the imperfections of this. Of course, remember, we saw Solander's famous for it. He thought he would change the world. Eventually, he decided he would change his city, then his family. He finally said, "I'll work on myself, and that'll be maspik." But anyway, the truth of the matter is, though, one has to understand that tolerance, or the ability—tolerance isn't even the best word—but the notion of exposing oneself to the whole diversity of Torah can sometimes be a reflection of indifference and lack of commitment, because once again, it is very, very hard as one tries to assimilate many, many ideas, some of which are contradictory. You tend to be like the proverbial donkey that dies of starvation because it can't decide whether it goes to the water or goes to the grain. It's equidistant. And therefore, the argument is that unless you have a clearly defined shita, one will become pariv and less passionate and less involved. And there's an interesting mashal Rosh Radran once gave, the great Maggid of Yerushalayim, when people were criticizing some of the demonstrations against Chilul Shabbos, which sometimes, you know, involved improper activities. So he gave a story from his own life. It's a famous story. Now Pesach Kron memorialized it in his books, that once a boy was riding a bicycle and fell off the bicycle and had a big gash in his head, and it was bleeding. And Rosh Radran, who was already an older man, you know, took the boy and started carrying him and running up a hill to take him to the Kupat Chalim, or take him to the hospital, emergency room. And there was an older woman that he knew who was on the merpeset, and she was calling down on him and saying, "Reb Shalom, don't worry, he's a child, children heal very quickly, no big deal, accidents happen, don't worry, don't be so nervous, you don't have to run." Anyway, he's running in her direction, and as he gets closer, she sees it's her grandson, Meirka. So all of a sudden, she starts shrieking, "Meirka, Meirka, oy vey, the Abishas all health, and oy vey," and she really gets very, very upset. Anyway, Baruch Hashem, the child was okay, but Rav Shalom asked her later, you know, 2 minutes before, you were saying, "Everything's okay, the Abishas all health, and all of a sudden, you're so upset?" She says, "Well, it's my America. When it's my America, I get upset." Rav Shradran said that for a from Yid in Yerushalayim, Shabbos is our America, meaning to say that the fact that people get upset, the fact that people get passionate, the fact that people get angry, is sometimes a sign of how deeply connected they are to the mitzvah. So we have to understand that tolerance can sometimes be apathy, can sometimes be indifference, can sometimes be coldness. So the ideal combination is indeed to find some type of framework where we have passion and strength and conviction, but at the same time have a sensitivity to the different approaches that exist within Klal Yisrael, and the fact that even Chutz L'Machane, there are different types of people in the world that if we live lives of decency and Kiddush Hashem, we will reach them in one way or the other. Now, if you ask, where do you find such an impossible combination? The answer is Avram Avinu is indeed that impossible combination. On one hand, he is Avram Ho'ivri. Avram the Hebrew. Chazal say the meaning of Ivri is that, I mean literally the other side of the river, but it means he could stand on one side of the river and the whole world could be a desert. Meaning to say, so firm in his emunah, he was so firm in his understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that even if the whole world were over the Avodah Zarah, he stood firm and strong and unwavering and uncompromising. He did not compromise truth. He did not dilute truth. He did not distort truth. He communicated that truth to everybody who would, not only who would listen, but he went out of his way to gather people, to teach them about Hashem. And yet, that same Avram Avinu is the one, as the Nitziv says, who prays for the Chaitim, the sinners of Sodom, the degenerates. He even argues with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He bargains with HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what we would regard as worthless ice warps. You know, what is Avram? I mean, imagine if somehow we had a city like Sodom. Some say we do have cities like Sodom, but we have a city like Sodom, and some gadol would come, some gadol or Rosh Yeshiva would come in that city and pray for Hashem's mercy on that city. We would see pronouncements in Yateid Neman. We would say, maybe Rosh Yeshiva's a righteous man, but perhaps, you know, he's mischaber too much to Rishayim. Maybe it's because of his trip to America. He got influenced. You know, Lahavdol, a million Havdolos. I'm just thinking Dostoevsky actually has a story in the Christian tradition. What if Yeshua would come back to earth? He would be crucified by the Catholic Church. You know, it's the same idea. Lahavdol mea ve'elef Havdolos. But it's the same idea that sometimes the authentic teachings of the religion somehow get distorted with the passage of time. So if we go back to what's often called the first Jew, although that's a bit of a confusing term, we can incorporate the notion of Avram Ho'ivri and the Avram that's mispowel for Sodom. They were not two people. They were two sides of the same person. And I'll just end with a thought from the Gra in this commentary on Mishle. The Pasuk says in Mishle, Kemayim haponim el ponim, kein lei fa adam bi adam, as water reflects the face that you look into it, so too is the heart of one man. So the Gra says, actually it's the Pasuk Pshat in the Pasuk, but the Gra is in Mefarish it a bit more clearly. And that is, when you look at the water, when you smile at the water, you see a smiling face. When you frown at the water, you see a frowning face. The heart of one human being towards another human being will be a mirror or reflection of what we show that other human being. We show another human being love and respect and a recognition of their dignity and their worth, then they will feel that way towards us as well. They will be open to whatever truth we have to share with them, and they will respond. If, on the other hand, we reflect towards that other person rejection, delegitimation, demonization, chutz l'machane, apikorsis, and kofar, then indeed that is how they will view us as well. Whether they use those religious terms or not, that is how they will view us. But they even tell a story with Rav Chaim Volozhiner, that he once paskened against a butcher, that all the butcher's meat was treif. So in Europe, butchers tended to be big, strong people. That was kind of the stereotype in the European meisim. And the butcher lured Rav Chaim Volozhiner to the forest, somehow saying he had a shaila to ask him. And when Rav Chaim is there with the butcher, so the butcher takes his meat cleaver and says, unbelievable, says, I'm going to kill you because you were mafsid me a lot of money. And a Talmud is watching from a distance with absolute horror. He sees the butcher lifting up this big knife. And then from a distance, all of a sudden, he sees the butcher throwing the knife down, getting on his knees, and sobbing and begging Rav Chaim's forgiveness. And he didn't know what happened. So when Rav Chaim got back, he said to Rav Chaim, he says, Chasida Shemaisa, right? So this is the time of the Chasidim Snagim. You did a miracle like a rebbe. So Rav Chaim said, I didn't do a miracle. I was just Mekayim the Pasuk, as my Rebbe explained it. Because when this person was going to kill me, I knew I would be in trouble unless I tried to concentrate on the positive aspects of his action. I tried to understand how hurt he was, how devastated he was, the difficulties he had in Parnassa. And even though he was trying to kill me, I want to feel rachmanis for him. And I knew, this is Rav Chaim, if I felt rachmanis and love for him, he would love me, kamayim hapanim el panim. Now, again, I do not try this at home or in any any other neighborhood. And we know, I mean, again, and it's not, and not even a funny matter, because we know about Vanaseinu Harabim that just in the past few weeks, you know, we've had awesomely difficult, tragic events. And this is part of life that we cannot explain. But as a general rule of life, not dealing with extreme radical evil, but as a general rule of life, this yesod is a true yesod, that the feelings we mirror towards others will be reciprocated. So may all of us be zeicha to try to build the Beis HaMikdash in whatever way that we can, and in that way this should be the last Tisha B'Av.